Jones Network. Tomorrow's news today.
If you are receiving this transmission, you are the resistance.
This is Matt Bracken, and this is my first time doing the Sunday evening show when we wrap up the week, look at the next week, and pretty much let it all hang out. I'm filling in for Alex. I know you all wish he was here, so do I, but it is what it is, and we do the best we can with the tools at our hands. And there's so much going on. I mean, we could go in so many directions right now. I'm going to start in Ireland, which I think is like the epicenter or the focal point as like the ultimate beta test for population replacement. You know, if we can do this, the globalists, if they can do this to a small, cohesive, homogenous country like Ireland, then where can't they do it? And in the terms of being a beta test, it's how much can we inject? How many foreigners can we inject before the Irish roll back and just say, that's it, no more? You know, so they can dial and modulate the inputs and study Ireland like it's a lab experiment. You know, we can go to 20% population replacement, 25% population replacement. What if we bring in more Muslims? What if we bring in more Africans? What if we bring in more subcontinent Indians? At what point will the Irish absolutely just rebel? Then we'll just turn it down a little bit until they're quiet again. Because, you know, we've got all the other government tools. We can cut off their, you know, cut off all kinds of their government, medical, housing, just screw them over while giving more and more to foreigners. And at what point do the Irish say enough? Well, we saw yesterday in Paris after, what, a soccer football match that their new migrants are burning down, you know, cities, Paris, right to the Eiffel Tower, trashing the cities. At what point do the Europeans say, that's it, enough? And at the same time, European leaders, are they talking about this actual invasion inside of their country that they facilitated? No, they're talking about Russia. They're talking about gearing up these countries, which are already on the edge of collapse. They're talking about gearing up these countries, reindustrializing, God knows with what energy, with what, you know, with what materials you would need, gearing up to fight Russia. When obviously the enemy is right inside of their country already. The enemy that they brought in to wreck their countries. So it's a very hard time to understand, very difficult period to understand. We're not seeing arson riots in Ireland at this point, but we are seeing Irish people and other immigrants actually being you know, kidnapped, raped, robbed, mugged, murdered, stabbed. And in every case, the Irish government has known about these people, has let them walk the streets freely, given them jobs ahead of Irish people. So it's a very good test bed, a very good test experiment. When we come back on the other side, I'm going to introduce you to a friend of mine in Ireland, somebody I know in real life, Peter Connolly, who has served in the Irish military, who knows everything that's going on inside of Ireland, and has served outside of Ireland, been all over, and we're going to have a great discussion about this, so we'll see you in just a couple of minutes.
Most banned man in America, Alex Jones.
I want to want you all to know something. Alex Jones was right.
Alex is right about far more than he's wrong.
Alex has been right on for over a decade.
I don't care how you slice it, dice it, flip it up, or rub it down. Alex Jones was right.
Think about how frustrated we are if you've been awake for a year or two. Imagine being like an Alex Jones or those guys who've been awake for like decades.
Alex Jones called this years ago. Years ago.
Alex Jones never bought the Russia hoax, not for a second.
You are one of the great thinkers of this.
You are a martyr to the First Amendment.
The government fears Alex Jones.
That's why the globalists hate me, is because I'm exposing their corporate worldwide tyranny.
Discover trends and global developments years before they happen, right here on The Alex Jones Show.
Okay, I'm back, and I'm going to be joined in a moment with my in-real-life friend, Peter Connolly, in Ireland, 5 hours ahead of me in Florida. But we have, you know, walked the same roads in Ireland, and I think that Peter will become a valuable guest on Alex Jones' different programs in the future. You know, this is another element of this, Ireland being the beta test ground, is that Ireland is not like France or Britain. They never had colonies. They never oppressed people or boosted them up, however you want to look at it, in Africa or India or China or anywhere else. The Irish were the oppressed. You know, the Irish were the colonized, not the colonizers. So there's nobody that can say, I'm coming back to Ireland because you oppressed us, you know, in Congo or in Zimbabwe or Bangladesh. So it's a perfect test ground. In fact, the Irish have been the only inhabitants of Ireland since the last ice age. Now, there were inputs along the way, you know, the Normans, who were secondhand Vikings who had settled in France, they came to England and then into Ireland. So you had Viking incursions, you had the English obviously invading 800 years ago and ongoing. But there was never a time when the Irish, indigenous Irish, went outside of Ireland to oppress people. Yeah, there were times when the Irish had to leave Ireland because they were being starved out. For example, in the 19th century Irish famicide, which was a period when there was a potato blight famine, while at the same time Ireland was still a rich agricultural country, but all of the good fertile land was owned by the English invaders, the absentee landlords. They were shipping, you know, corn and cattle and everything else out of Ireland while the Irish were starving to death. So yes, the Irish had to, many of the Irish just to survive left Ireland, but they never were the colonizers. And now the Irish, you have to separate Northern Ireland, you know, the UK part called Ulster from the Republic of Ireland, the southern counties, because you know, we all are thinking, well, the Irish, aren't they very aggressive and you know, quick tempered? What happened to the IRA fighting like they were in the 70s? That was Ulster, Northern Ireland. The Republic of Ireland that we're talking about has been a peaceful land basically for more than a century, since their own Irish Revolution in the 1920s when they threw out British rule. Since then, for more than a century, the Irish have been an extremely peaceful people. They call themselves the land of 10,000 welcomes. You know, we're just friendly. Everybody loves us. Come on in. And this kind of universal empathy for their fellow man has been turned against them, because it's hard for the Irish to just say, I'm sorry, mate, you got to shove off home. We have too many of you, and we want to stay Ireland. So that's the knife edge that Ireland is on right now. And I'm going to bring in Peter now. I don't know if he's up on the channel yet, but you know, Peter and I have these discussions constantly. You know, at what point, what's going to happen? Will it be political? Will it be something more kinetic or violent than just political? Or will Ireland just be overrun? You know, in another decade, will Ireland be more Muslim and Hindu than Irish? Because that's the way it's trending. So if Peter's here, let's bring him up and we can add him to the discussion.
Hi, Matt.
Hello, how are you doing?
How are you doing? How are we for sound?
Good, very good.
Just looking at those images there of France just in the last 24, 48 hours. That was quite incredible. And we've seen this before as well with, I don't know which city it was as to whether it was Paris, but you might have seen that video shot of two guys coming up in a car and getting out and with Kalashnikovs and discharging them. You know, it's like something like that you might see of a scene of Syria or somewhere like that, you know?
Yeah,
but
this is
France, and I can say I think you know my own memories of France, you know, and all of these wonderful places like Paris and Nice, etc., and that kind of thing. It's changed so much, you know, and that kind of reputation for Paris and the kind of the image that you might have of it, it's just gone. And there hasn't been, you know, we haven't really seen much in the sense of kind of, hey, you know, we want our Paris back, you know?
Yeah. And this does kind of relate to Ireland, because if you can put up number 7, which is like two kind of images of Dublin, the population of Dublin, that's the number 7 image I sent. If you take over the capital of a country like Dublin or Paris, you've pretty much got the country by the gonads, by the short hairs. Once you take over the capital, which is like the political center of gravity, do you guys have that the picture number 7? There you go. On the top, so the green are Irish people. Where it's dark green, that's Irish people. And where it's lighter, that's not Irish people. So you can just see how in, you know, from 2006 to 2022, and believe me, it's a lot worse by now, Dublin's almost becoming a non-Irish city. And because it's still quote unquote a democracy, that means that the people that live there are voting. And in Ireland, the people in control of Ireland, you can become a citizen of Ireland practically, you know, months after walking into the country and be given voting rights right away. So the political center of gravity is clearly shifting towards more and more immigration. Once you control a capital, there's not much people in small towns can do. You know, during the French Revolution, the communist revolutionaries took over Paris. Once that was done, they could go out to any little town with the guillotines and control every small town or other city in France. So there's not much hope that the, you know, the smaller outlying areas of Ireland are going to rise up. If you could put up like number 2, that's the IPAS. It's spelled IPAS, and it stands for International Protection Accommodation Services. But in Ireland, it's referred to as the IPAS. And these are all IPAS centers, and the flags show like who the majority of the people there are. But you can see the important thing is they're just spread right across the country. It's not like they're just in Dublin. Every small town in Ireland now has these IPAS centers. And what they do is they take hotels that are maybe they're doing well or not doing well with just tourism, but they offer a deal to the hotel owners. We'll pay you double. Forget the tourist from America. Forget the tourist from anywhere else. We'll pay you much more, guaranteed, you know, set price to host fighting age men from God knows where, right? And you'll make double, triple what you were making struggling to bring in tourists. And too many people have taken this deal. And in fact, a lot of these hotel owners weren't even the original hotel owners. Somehow they get a loan, a subsidized loan. They buy the hotel. Then they get this deal to bring in, you know, hundreds or thousands of fighting age foreign men, host them in this hotel. They bring in, they have full restaurant service, so the men are well fed. And these, I guess you would only call them traitor hotel owners, they make a fortune. They may or may not even live in Ireland. But meanwhile, the rest of that town around there, who's going to be a tourist in an island, in a town or a city where there's hundreds of foreign men walking around, you know, like they are in Paris there? So it not only, you know, takes a big hotel out of the tourist trade, but it wrecks the tourist trade for the rest of the city. And this is going on all over Ireland. And all you have to do is look at France last night to see where this leads. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Peter. I mean,
yeah,
here I am
think
in America
that,
talking
you
about
know,
it.
When we look at the scenes last night there in Paris, and we look at kind of as to how much accelerated, or shall we say, this, I suppose, if I was to give it some sort of a timeline on this, but just before I give the timeline, in terms of if we look at how it is progressed in countries like Sweden, Germany, France, where, you know, just to give an example, in Sweden, and I suppose really the, you know, the their kind of point of change, I suppose, really, I suppose, started kind of in the early 2000s. Now, where this got to is, for example, in 2018, and if you look at the Swedish police website, which is something that I do look at from time to time, and it's nicely done, and it's in, I think it's currently it's in about 16 languages, so you can look into, you know, you don't have to be a Swedish speaker, but if we look at it, they started recording data on bombings. This kind of began to get seriously out of hand maybe around 2018. And that kind of those first two or three years, you know, was maybe something like 60 odd bombings or something like that a year. And then we get to, I think it was 23, we had 147 bombings. In 24, we had 317 bombings. I know that for 2025, there was a record in the first two or two, 3 months of something like, it was like a bombing a day. But they actually haven't published, or maybe I'm wrong, but they haven't published the data for 2025 as I see it. And I think that it's just, it's exponential as to how this has escalated. And, you know, what we're witnessing there is that they're bringing in people from different countries and that kind of thing. And we typically associate them, obviously, you know, country and a flag and that kind of thing. But what we don't understand is that these people are coming in with various pre-existing tribal structures. And those tribal structures will gravitate. And, you know, if there's a hierarchy, et cetera, irrespective of where they are in the world, they will go along with that. And so we're seeing, basically in Sweden, we're seeing these turf wars. We're seeing the same in France, in Belgium, in Germany. And what's also, I think, you know, before we saw the war start in Ukraine, it was the thing that I was keeping an eye on. And that was the records from different police agencies around Europe in terms of their records of, you know, search operations for where they've intercepted weapons and that kind of thing. And, you know, typically maybe with a kind of a gangland type thing, you know, as to whether it's kind of, you know, some sort of kind of small arms, you know, pistols and that kind of thing. But, you know, when you see some of the caches that have been intercepted with everything in them, you know, from mortars, landmines, the whole lot. I think there's a bit scant in relation to information on that, but that was back, I think, maybe around in 2016. And if we look at that as well with the height of the attacks, some of the real high-profile attacks, things like Bataclan, Nice truck attack, etc., 2014 to 2016. But there was an intercept, and we've spoken about that before, in Spain, and it's on the Spanish police website. And that intercept was over 10,000 pieces of ordnance. And it was like, you know, this, you look at this and you're kind of scratching your head, like saying, you know, where did the money come for that? And what's the intent eventually of that? So, yeah, worrying. And, you know, I think that a lot of the general public are oblivious to this. I think I'll just kind of finish on this one point. But last week, the Belgian authorities, and this is something that we've discussed before, the Belgian authorities made an announcement to the effect of that those, a lot of those people that were moving across the channel into the United Kingdom, that is quite a high percentage of them are former military, or they have some sort of military training. You know, that's something we've said before, you know, so all of this and no questions asked in relation to who's coming into and who's moving across Europe.
Yeah. You know, it's important to understand something has really changed. And this also relates to, say, the Ukraine-Russia war, or the America-Israel versus Iran war. We used to be able to, say, look at a ship from a reconnaissance plane. So in the early 60s, Russia's bringing rockets, you know, missiles into Cuba. We could see that. You know, even though the cargo is hidden on the ship, our analysts could say they're bringing in missiles. When they're unloading the ship, the U-2s could say those are big missiles, right? Those are like, you know, more than 100 feet long missiles. Now, what really matters are much, much smaller cargoes or smaller pieces of ordnance. So especially since the Russia-Ukraine war, I think it's estimated like, you know, a third or a half of everything sent to Ukraine is diverted. The cash is going for super yachts and a lot of the arms, you know, five trucks full of arms go down the road. Three of them turn off to be sold on the black market. And with the European Union wide open now, you know, if you get a truck into, you know, any European country, it can be anywhere the next day. And the takeover of Syria, which a couple of years ago, was done with like little Toyota pickup trucks and motorbikes, where you could fit like 30 or 40 of these Chinese motorbikes. You're only talking like 200cc motorbikes that are big enough for two men with a little bit of training. And they could just cross the desert, spread out, hit all kind of targets. Nobody has got a big target. Where's a tank to hit? You know, where's a ship to hit? Where's a big missile battery to hit? No, it's like being attacked by army ants because they're just in Toyota pickups and motorbikes, you know, with machine guns. Well, what we're seeing now in Europe are these weapons are flowing into places like Sweden. When they're talking about bombings, they're talking about military grade ordnance from grenades on up. You know, Javelin missiles were like found in South America that were sent to Ukraine. So it's on a world market now. If you can put up number 11, just bringing it back to Ireland, when you think about a cargo container, there is what 1 in 1,000 cargo containers is actually opened up and inspected. But you can put enough weapons in one cargo container. You know, thousands of AK-47s will fit in a 20-foot cargo container. And a cargo container like that, just a 20-footer, can fit on the back of a small truck that will roll it off, you know, that has the capability to just deliver it anywhere. So you could see a container like that rolling down your street in America, in Ireland, in France, anywhere, and you wouldn't look at it twice. And you don't know what's inside of it. Is it 40 motorbikes or is it 2,000 AK-47s? You don't know and you won't know until they're opened up. The hard part about this kind of an invasion of Europe is bringing in the men. The soldiers, that's the hard part. Bringing in 2,000 men is not simple to do when you're bringing them in 20, 30, 40 per rubber boat. That's difficult. Now they're in hotels, being well-fed, learning the lay of the land, you know, having driver's licenses and free bus passes, free cell phones, networking with each other, learning that county in any country in Europe that they're in. And when the day comes when there is finally a real pushback and European politicians are talking about the expulsion, the remigration, That's when we're going to find out that all of these cargo containers have been laid all over Europe. I mean, we've seen mosques in Europe over the last decade where next door or underneath the mosque, thousands of machine guns. And they keep it quiet because they don't want problems. Just like with the rape gangs, they don't want problems. So they suppress the news and keep it quiet. But this is absolutely coming. And, you know, just arson riots like we're seeing in France last night, that's just people getting rowdy, angry, and a little bit ahead of schedule. But when it's really going to happen, it's not going to be a Bataclan massacre. It's going to be 100 Bataclans all across the city on the same night, you know, with thousands of AK-47s. And that's going to happen when re-migration becomes a real subject. So I'm sorry for, you know, go ahead, Peter, and add in where you want.
Yeah. I think when you're referring to look, these things, it's not making it up. I mean, these are just kind of having to search out through the news and in certain cases, you know, having to search out for kind of local stories because they're not being broadcast kind of Europe-wide or internationally wide. But, I mean, we've discussed that one before, and it's on one of the German police websites in relation to a huge find, again, of weaponry. And in an adjoining building, I'm not going to go into the details, that was in Berlin, and that was astronomical. And, you know, we're not talking kind of somebody, you know, people might try and – we've seen that with – I think it was one of the Spanish finds that they were trying to push it off as being kind of some sort of historical collector or something like that. It was rubbish. Like it's all relatively modern ordnance. And the same within Berlin, that ordnance that was discovered. I mean, that was all, you know, as you say, Kalashnikovs or whatever. It was all the same model. And as to wherever that's, you know, being moved around from one hot spot in the world to another spot. But again, we're just coming back on a comment there in relation to the shipping containers. I mean, that's another one there that came up that was, I don't know exactly what the quantity of it was, but it was a number of 40-foot shipping containers that were intercepted in a port in Greece. And I mean, the documentation on that, they were being handled apparently by some particular NGO listed as humanitarian aid and on its way to Sweden. And again, the same, you know, you can use your imagination as to what it was packed with, you know, but yeah, it's not on a scale like, you know, if we're in, you know, talking some sort of kind of different types of activities, like say, for example, you know, it's the movement of drugs or something or narcotics and that kind of thing, you know, depending on what that might be, you know, but, you know, sometimes there's weaponry that's associated with that, but it's more so kind of like as to whether it's part of the deal or it's, you know, for protection of the movement of whatever it is that they're moving. But we're not seeing, we have never witnessed something that is taking place that is, shall we say, is on a military scale buildup, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and we've just got 30 seconds till we go to the next break, but as with these grooming gangs, these, you know, mass rape gangs, often covered up by the police who are increasingly, you know, Mohammedans themselves, when they do find these weapons caches, you can bet that they keep it quiet under the you know, the cover story that we don't want to hurt relations with our new Muslim, you know, citizens. So we'll see you again in a few minutes.
We have to get more people hired. We have to finish the new big studios. We have to have our legal defense and offense, and we have to move forward. So now is the time. Have we not delivered to you in the fight against tyranny? Have you not delivered supporting us as Symbiotic? A win-win situation. Like he says in Gladiator after he chops up, you know, the four guys just a few seconds. He says, are you not entertained? Are you not entertained? And I say, are you not empowered? Are the tyrants not scared? Are they not coming after me and my crew? You want somebody to fight? You want somebody to stand up for you? Well, then you got to back them. And those that have backed us, I salute you from the bottom of my heart. And those that have shared the articles and videos, that's great. But it's different classes of people. There's people that tune in and get the knowledge, but are scared or lazy or whatever. Then there's people that at least share the articles and videos and Paul Revere it. We appreciate you. Okay? So you got like copper, you know, on the bottom. At least you listen, but I hope people learn from this through osmosis or something. Then you got the silver folks that at least share the articles and videos to wake up other people. And then you got the gold standard, the people that do it all, and the people that get great products that are smart enough to say, wow, this guy really knows what he's talking about. I believe him. He'd only sell me something that works. And then they try it. We have a 90%+ reorder rate with supplements because I wouldn't sell you something that doesn't work. I'm not stupid. That's why I don't serve evil. I know the second, third, fourth order events of it will destroy me. Plus, I don't like it. I don't enjoy it. I feel good being truthful. I feel good being honest. I feel good stomping tyrants politically into the ground nonviolently. Slashing their throats nonviolently. Stabbing ice picks in their heads nonviolently. Cutting their heads off nonviolently. Ripping their entrails out politically nonviolently. I like just breaking their bones and grinding them down to make my bread. Fee-fi-fo-fum. I smell the blood of satanic globalist scum. Be they alive or be they dead, I'll grind their bones to make my bread. You want somebody to fight for you? Well, you better believe you got it. The real McCoy. The spirit of resistance and victory. And they know it, and it's why they fear it. And if you will simply join me and ask God for this spirit to lead, God, and direct us, the spirit that overcomes, God doesn't give us over a spirit of weakness and fear, but one is a roaring lion that conquers, that destroys tyrants, that overcometh. And when the enemy comes in like a flood, the spirit of the Lord lifts up a standard against it. And we are the crucible. We are the shield of the people. We are the standard. We have the spirit. We have the will. But we have to have no fear and commit to this fight. Give me your word of mouth. Give me your prayers to God for our providence and support, because if God be with us, who can stand against us? And financially support us now at thealexjonesstore.com. Become a VIP. Cancel any time. It's no commitment. You just get all the best deals. $30 a month spend, instantly $40 to buy whatever you want. You make 10 bucks right there. Special offers, sales on top of sales for everybody, and special offers at thealexjonesstore.com. Commit. Be a VIP. You can also donate on the site at the donate button. Just take action now. But those of you that have supported us, you know who you are, and I thank you from the bottom of my soul.
Days, weeks, and even years ahead of the news cycle, AlexJonesLive.com is tomorrow's news today. Days, weeks, and even years ahead of the news cycle, AlexJonesLive.com is tomorrow's news today.
You are listening to an AJN Live Frontline Report. If you are receiving this transmission, you are the resistance.
I'm back, and it's hard to get used to. It's hard to get used to not using the old iWars show. That's difficult. It's a kind of a bone stuck in the throat, but it is what it is. The lawfare just rolls on, and Alex Jones has to keep on keeping on. So. You know, now it's the AlexJonesStore.com. It's not even his store, right? I mean, to stay ahead of these lawfare dogs is a full-time job. And it means that sometimes Alex can't even be here. And sometimes that's why I'm here. Because the law dogs are on his heels 24/7. But if you want to keep these programs running, you need to support the show. And that's AlexJonesShow.com now, and there are all kind of deals. If you buy products, you're going to be hooked up with a chance to win custom H1 Hummers, Dodge Challengers, cash prizes. But you have to go to this store and buy some products. Otherwise, there is no show, right? You know, you can get free shipping on $99. You each tier up. There's more freebies, but you have to visit the AlexJonesStore.com. Anyway, I'm back with Peter, and we're talking about Ireland and Europe and basically the Islamic invasion of the West. And it's not only now the Islamic invasion of the West, because just by sheer numbers, the Hindus, the Indians are just coming over in just by the millions. And anywhere that they come, in some ways, they're more effective at invading and colonizing than the Muslims, who are extremely tribal at the at their own grassroots levels. But once the Hindus come in, their smartest guys come over, they get a job with the corporation, take over the human resource department. And after that, if you're just a white American or white Irish, forget it. You're never getting a job. So, you know, if let's see, it's number six there, the India map. Compared to little tiny Ireland, India is 47 times bigger than Ireland. And its population is like, almost 300 times bigger. So because you're in a country in America, Ireland, you think, well, you know, if a few Indians come, what can that do? If just 1% of India moved to Ireland, Ireland would become India, period. 1%. They wouldn't notice that in India. But to the Indians that just took over Ireland, Ireland would still be a garden spot compared to India. They wouldn't stop at 20 million Indians. It'd be like, hey, there's room for 50 million more Indians. It'll still be better than Calcutta or New Delhi. But this empathy, this land of 10,000 welcomes, you know, this culture of openness and like everybody is our friend. We love tourists. Come to Ireland. This has been weaponized against the Irish. And I mean, it is at this point, I don't see how this tide is reversed. And we're not talking about something like the 1970s to 90s in Ulster in Northern Ireland, which was Catholic versus Protestant. This is a different thing. This is a different kind of a pathogen. The Irish have never seen this, just being supplanted in your own country. And at the top, your politicians are increasingly traitors. They'll take the shilling. They'll take the euro, get themselves rich while destroying their own country. I mean, too many Irish politicians, they look at Irish politics as like a farm team, a AAA team. What they're looking at is a job with an NGO or a job in Brussels with the EU. So selling out their own country is just a stepping stone on their career. Anyway, Peter Connolly knows a lot more about this than I do. So I'd like to just, you know, have him go take this wherever he wants.
Thanks, Matt. Just to come back to one of the points there, as I was saying about the statistics with Sweden, and it's a question that I typically put to people. You know, if we think of Sweden and, you know, some of the great places like Stockholm and Gothenburg, et cetera, and that kind of thing, and we have this kind of idea of the Swedes and that kind of thing, you know, maybe even, you know, reminiscing going back a number of years is things like the music of ABBA and all of this kind of thing. So, you know, generally, like if you, you know, maybe somebody, one of your listeners or some of your listeners did a trip around Europe or something and they, you know, they went to Sweden and they have this kind of image of what it's about. The question is that I would ask is that if, you know, we get to a stage where, as I mentioned about the series of bombings every year, 147, 317, you know, maybe for 2025, and I'm still not so sure, but it looks like something like at least 350. And the question that I think of, which is a straightforward question, is why did the Swedes decide to become so violent? Because, yeah. You know, if they're telling themselves, and if you watch the news, that's the way it's presented. You know, a Swedish man.
And if you look at Mohammed.
If you look at some of this is being carried out as well, and this is an issue that in Sweden it's something I've been following, is within the legal system, is that the age for what's considered as a serious crime, if I recall anyway, that this is this is something like less than 15 years of age. So if you look at the profile of a lot of people that are involved in things like, you know, gangland activity or, you know, assassinations or gangland hits and that kind of thing, they're 13 and 14 year olds. You know, you can imagine the physique of a 13 or 14 year old. And this is the, but, you know, the, well, there's a kind
even
of.
Even a monkey can pull the pin on a grenade.
Yeah. So this is the profile of some of the people, or a lot of the because the system as it exists, these people will not go to prison for, you know, serious crime. So, you know, what we've been witnessing for years is, you know, kind of still trying to perpetuate a story of that, oh, you know, everything's fantastic. And but really at this stage where it is, and I was just looking again just recently at the Swedish police website. And, you know, they're giving a profile of kind of, you know, perceived threats and that kind of thing societally and that, you know, for criminal activity or terrorism or whatever it is. And but, you know, they may be now beginning to open up about what the actual threat is. But they still have it up there up in the top of the profile as well as, you know, the dreaded far right. You know, the far right is still a huge threat.
For those of us who have studied this going back to the time of Muhammad, you know, this is a pattern that repeats century down century, you know, after century. The people in charge of the city, you know, the hypothetical city that's under Muslim attack, they receive private messages that, look, all you have to do is open the gates and let us in, and we'll allow you to keep your property and keep your title. If you resist us, you're going to wind up with your head in a basket, right? But if you just go along, you'll get along. And we can see this repeating currently in Europe, where, you know, you see the Prime Minister and King of England going over backwards to go to Eid feasts, you know, end of Ramadan, bringing Muslims into Christian cathedrals and English royal palaces. They're saying, don't hurt me. You know, I want to be the last one eaten by the alligator. And they're promised, you can keep your crown. You'll still be king. Just let us take over and keep your peasants from rebelling against us in the meantime. This pattern has been going on for more than 1,000 years, and it's almost foolproof. You know, switching real quick to Iran, just for a historical comparison, the Iranians, you know, beat the Greeks, they beat the Romans. You know, they were like Russia; they were invaded. It's a great place in the world in terms of its natural resources. Iran is very smart people. They have been invaded down the centuries, and they have repulsed invaders. But which invasion succeeded? The Islamic invasion. You know, this is like a stealth invasion. It's a slow, like a rust process. It's not like a knife or a tank. You know, it's a slow corrosion process. Just go along. And so this people that the Aryan, which is Iranians, they could beat the Greeks, the Romans, all of these invaders, but they succumbed to Islam. You know, when the Mongols, the Mongol horde, they came sweeping out of China and took over, you know, deep into Europe. They took over a lot of, you know, that's where the Crimean Tatars come from. So these are the guys that are like the toughest of raiders of all. You know, they invented the stirrup so they could fire arrows from the saddle. They would have three or four ponies each Mongol, so that they could just keep riding, switching horses. But what did they do when they got to Crimea? Who beat them? Islam. So the Crimean Tatars, toughest soldiers, toughest people ever, they became Islamic, because it's this slow corrosion process, this unrelenting corrosion process, and we're seeing that in Europe now. And I don't know at what point, you know, is there enough European strength left for somebody to rise up and resist it, it's very doubtful. I don't see where that's worked. It's been very few times in history where this process was reversed. One was in Spain, but it took 400 years for the Spanish to drive them out of Spain. 400 years. And those Spanish were very tough people. You know, they were like knights with starting with arrows and then crossbows, but they were very tough people, much tougher than we are today. It took them 400 years to drive the Moors out of Spain. So I don't think that European metrosexuals today, or their socialist / communist leaders, I don't see them ever. I see them surrendering. I see them keeping down the patriots, the nationalist patriots. I see them surrendering to Islam. And it's a very tough mathematical problem, because if you have a country that's, 45% hard left communist socialist that really hates their country, hates the concept of nationalism, hates Christianity, hates Western values, and then you add 15 or 20% immigrants that just want to have, want to flood into your country and take over, you've got a majority. We've seen that already in country after country in Europe, between the socialists and the invaders, third world invaders, mostly Muslims. That's a working majority. And so you're not going to be saved through democracy. Your democracy is going to nail this thing down tight. And in a century, Europe will be Islamic completely. Europe will be a Sharia place, maybe in 50 years. So I don't know at what point this is reversed. I'm sorry, Peter, go ahead.
Just to give some of the background as well, just for some of the listeners now, the scenarios in Europe are kind of, for some of the other countries, as I mentioned, the likes of, say, Germany or France, Sweden, etc. The process has been going on, quite some extent. By what we're witnessing in Ireland has been going on at a particular pace, but particularly since the end of COVID 2022. And we can really see that this process has really accelerated. Now, if you look at Ireland as well in terms of the demographics, like if you compare it to, say, the United Kingdom, I don't know exactly what the United Kingdom is. Maybe it's 65 million or something like that. But, shall we say 20 years ago, maybe Ireland was just touching over 4 million people. So it's very... it's a small geographically and a small population as well. So I think one of the things that, just reminiscing about this is that, and kind of the perception that people have in their minds, and, obviously different generations and that kind of thing as well. But, I remember growing up, we always had, say in summertime, we would have had an influx of people coming in, particularly students coming over from mainland Europe, places like France and Spain and that kind of thing, coming over to practice their English. And, you'd see something similar as well with, students in the university systems, or maybe people working for different companies. But, going beyond 30 years ago, there wasn't, say, the presence in Ireland of things like the multinational companies. The access, Europe is small in some sort of ways. I mean, to give it a context, from Dublin, say, to London is only, say, 50 minutes of a flight. You can be in Paris like in about an hour and a half. Poland and places like, two and a half hours away. It's not far. So we kind of, I don't know what our kind of perceptions are in some sort of ways of the world, but, Ireland may be coming out of kind of a particular time, particularly of the influence with, say, the Catholic Church and that kind of thing. And, this idea, maybe within the mentality of the people, of kind of, some sort of kind of, sophisticated kind of international type people. But I think, since... particularly being a small country, and with the way that it is now, should we say that we behave in a certain sense, is that one of the things at the moment is that with basically a situation that is existing across Europe with open borders, is that, well, basically anybody can come in. And there is, in general, a kind of a naivety, particularly, you know, if you were to travel around. I mean, look, I can remember at the age of 12 years of age, being on my own and making my way from, you know, A to B in London on the underground. That's sometime back in the 80s, but that would be apt. You wouldn't think of that in this day and age. That's what London was like back then. And so just to give it a kind of a context, in, you know, with the increments that have taken place with the what was originally the European Economic Community, the EEC, which kind of in a certain way is kind of a million miles away from what it is now in its current form as the European Union. That has come along, and that has been a slow kind of drip process of basically us relinquishing a lot of our kind of decisions, the opening of our borders, etc. And so if we look at, for example, back in 2004, which is a kind of a major milestone in Europe, was that the borders opened basically for European citizens to travel. And so in Ireland, which was one of the things that we saw, was this immediate kind of influx of people coming from Eastern Europe, in particular places like Poland and Latvia and Lithuania, some of the Baltic countries and that kind of thing. But there was never kind of really an issue as such with that. You know, the similar kind of people, and particularly like if you look at, say, Poland, similar to Ireland, you know, Catholic country, similar values, etc. There was also a kind of a thing as well, too, I think, about it in terms of the pressure that maybe, you know, if somebody is coming to another country because maybe for economic reasons and that kind of thing, and that that can be kind of somewhat of a kettling to that, in the sense of kind of, you know, having to go somewhere and nearly feel stranded. But, you know, as I mentioned, you can cheap flights and you can get backwards and forwards, and you know, Poland's 2 hours away and that kind of thing. So that kind of worked very well, I think, for everybody. But where then we start to see is kind of with the more of an influx, and the, for various reasons with taxes and that kind of thing, of multinational companies coming to Ireland and wanting to establish in particular things like their own headquarters and that kind of thing, and more of an influx of different people coming here, but coming here to, you know, coming here to work. And just to give it a context, back in 2000, Ireland's social welfare bill was something of the order of 9 billion euros a year. Now, we then roll on, and we went through the, you know, the 2 years of what took place with COVID, and just coming off the end of COVID then in 2022, with we had the starting of the war in Ukraine. Now, Ireland, as it currently stands, maybe a population around 5.4 million. But Ireland took in something like 120,000 Ukrainians. And if you wanted to put up there, I think it's picture number 7, the one that was with the, let me just have a look here, the one that was with the, showing all the flags of the, sorry, it's not, it's number 2, picture number 2. What we had was we had all this influx of people coming in from Ukraine, predominantly women and children, and yes, the, you know, the elderly and that kind of thing. One of the things that's important to understand with Ukraine is that, you know, thinking that, you know, well, I just leave the country. So one of the things that happened in the case of Ukraine was, you know, presidential order, is that men aged between, I think it was 18 to 60 years of age, could not leave the country. And one of the things in Ukraine as well is that you have like kind of an international passport, and you have a kind of an internal pass system. And so the men just weren't getting out. I mean, the you know, the airports were closed. If you wanted to get out of Ukraine at that time, more than likely you were going to make your way to somewhere like Poland or Romania or whatever. But so we have all of these people that are coming in, and in the true sense of, you know, refugees from a war, the men will be restricted from leaving because obviously there's a war to fight. And it's typically the women and children and the elderly. And that's what we saw in that initial stages of the starting of the war
in Ukraine. And that softened you up for the much bigger invasion to come.
Well, the thing was then, so people were, you know, have this idea, oh, there's a local hotel and they're going to put Ukrainians in it and the Ukrainians are coming in. And then all of a sudden there's a busloads of people that are coming in the middle of the night. And they're not Ukrainians. They're men from wherever. And so you could have had a town, let's say, you know, I don't know, say a town was a very small town, say with 600 people. And in the middle of the night, 200 men have been brought in. Now, if you go back, I just wanted to make a point there. If you look at that picture number two with all of the flags on it, and there's a listing there, I think, of the different countries. So we can understand that, yes, there's a war in Ukraine. If you look at it, for example, Nigeria, I'm not aware of a war in Nigeria. Georgia, no. Oh, what's the next one?
They can just get off the airplane. They can just get off the airplane, throw away their documents, and they're voting in Irish elections a year later.
Yeah, Algeria. I don't think there's been a war in Algeria since 2001. I mean, going down further.
And even if there was, why is it all the young men coming?
Yeah.
Why is it? Ghana, why is it just the young, strong men coming and being India, put up in hotels and fed?
Yeah. What would typically internationally is the kind of what the normal protocol is going to be, is that the men are going to be severely restricted from going anywhere. You're going to be, if there's a major war, you're going to be conscripted in, you know?
Clearly, that's not what's been going on. And it's been going on with the, you know, collusion of the traitor class across Europe. We've only got a minute left, so we have to wind this hour up now. But I say keep our eye on Ireland. I am still, you know, slowly writing a book about it, set a little bit in the future, one of my novels. But Ireland, I think, is going to be a flashpoint. I just don't know what it's going to take, you know, how it's going to happen. But if you just go to Irish parks, public places, the Irish are already outnumbered. I mean, where it counts, you can look at total statistics and say, oh, there's still a majority. But for how long? When you're in public, the Irish are already outnumbered, and mostly by young men, foreign men. So thanks, Peter, for sharing the hour with us. And I'll be back after the break at the top of the next hour. Talk to you again soon.
These new data centers will oversee everyone in the galaxy. I will be in full control.
Power levels are stable. Proceed with the install. Copy that. Installing the module now. Connection confirmed. All green.
Cable secured. Power to the cluster. Initiating boot sequence. Component locked. Running diagnostics. Archive systems online. Report to command.
Construction team, report status. Power grid stable, TK-421. Cabling complete, no faults. Proceed to phase two for the Empire.
Things are going according to plan. The Emperor will be happy. The Empire demands perfection.
Status report. Any anomalies?
Diagnostics are clear, sir.
Proceed with the calibration. Watch for fluctuations.
I find your desire for privacy insignificant. The Empire's new data network will observe every corner of the galaxy, every signal, every act of disloyalty.
A disturbance in the Force there is. Feel it, you can.
Those who obey have nothing to fear. Those who resist will be terminated.